Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency Weekend podcast. I'm Dayan Fanning. Most of our coverage this weekend is about Ukraine. It is the issue that occupies most of our thoughts, I would imagine, most of the time. We have other articles as well. We have other pieces. But this is the story that concerns us all, the suffering and terror inflicted on the Ukrainian people continues to shock and appall us, and the consequences for everybody remain uncertain and potentially catastrophic. So in this podcast today, we're talking to two people. The first person we're talking to is Johnny O'Reilly, who has been writing for The Currency since last weekend on what's been happening on the ground, first in Kyiv and this weekend from Odessa. And then we talked to Vladimir Ishenko, a Ukrainian academic based in Dresden, about what this has meant for Ukraine. It's actually something Johnny touches upon as well. But Vladimir has spent a lot of his career detailing nationalism in Ukraine and beyond. And we talked about the nationalism of Vladimir Putin and how much of a factor, if any, that has been in his actions. But also what this resistance and what this has done for the nation of Ukraine in the most terrible of circumstances. But first of all, we spoke to Johnny O'Reilly in Odessa, and I asked him to talk first about the journey from Kyiv, where he's lived, and Johnny has lived in Kyiv for a number of years, the journey from there to the other end of the country, to Odessa, and what that was like.
Yeah, normally it's about a 6-hour journey, 5-hour journey. Actually, it only took us about 6 or 7 hours. It was quicker on the road because there was less cars there, but it was slowed down by the many checkpoints. So, we would stop at a checkpoint, and, you know, if we were clever enough, we would anticipate the checkpoint and take a left or a right off the main road and circumnavigate it, because like one checkpoint, we ended up in a queue for like 45 minutes. So these checkpoints are all over the country now, and they're straight out of World War II. You have basically kind of constructions, if you like, made out of sandbags, and you can see high velocity rifles and machine guns pointing out of the checkpoint. Could be anything from like just a small one with about 5 or 10 men up to like men, and typically you have a couple of big cement blocks to prevent cars from driving through without stopping. And then you have these kind of very large metal girders from train, the metal train girder, which are all welded together into these little kind of three axis spikes. Mm. And they're there to prevent tanks from from rolling over the. But these checkpoints are manned by the Territorial Army, which is it's kind of halfway between a true army and a volunteer organization. But there are about 1.5 million people in this Territorial Army, many of them in their 40s and older. The younger ones are in the army proper. These men, they're all men, mostly a small percentage of women. They're stopping everybody, and they're asking for papers, documentations. Really what they're looking for are saboteurs. Word diversante, which you can imagine, it's about people who information for the enemy that is useful in the battlefield context. So in the cities, what was that these hordes of saboteurs fanned out cities in the last few weeks and identified buildings for bombardment. simply by going onto the top of the roofs of the buildings, and they discovered a lot of these little special kind of light emitters that communicated to either to the Sputniks, the Sputniks, or the aerial unmanned vehicles. And this information is then kind of put into, is then computerized and given to the cruise missile systems to determine where precisely to bomb. So these, like if you think about it, the 30% of the country typically votes for a pro-Russian party. And out of that 30%, there would be a significant minority who would be so pro-Russian that they would take up arms against the Ukrainian government. So these are the people who have been engaged by the invading Russian force to go incognito behind their enemy lines in Ukraine and identify targets, share useful information, commit acts of arson. In one case, they were discovered having blown up an electricity station outside Kyiv. So these saboteurs are there to create havoc and chaos and to help the invade.
And when did you leave Kyiv?
So I have an apartment right in the center of Kyiv beside the Maidan. There are quite a lot of important government buildings nearby, including the headquarters of the SBU, which is the successor to the Ukrainian KGB building, which has been declared a target by the Russian Minister of Defense. So I'm 200 meters away from that building. So as the first night of bombardment, I stayed in my house. I think I stayed there in one more night. And then I decided it was unwise to just, and then I left. So that was 5-6 days ago. I went to a friend's house in the countryside about 40 miles south of the city. And there I brought in a couple of my friends who were other journalists, and about 6 of us stayed there for about 5 days. And most days, but not every day, we would then go into the city, into Kyiv, to report on what's happening, and then drive out before the curfew started, which most days was like 7 o'clock, but on a couple of days it was 5 o'clock. And then over the first weekend, there was a 48-hour curfew, so we didn't even leave the house.
And what were you seeing in Kyiv over those days, like over that time? Because, you know, as there's been such tension and such fear and terror about what is coming, and that keeps ramping up. Like, what is it doing for the people who are there? Because we talked, you know, we'll talk to him later in this podcast. I talked to Ukrainian academic Volodymyr Ryshenko, and his parents, he was telling us, are still in the city and don't want to leave because they don't want to become refugees. So there must be this terrible conflict for an awful lot of people there.
Yeah, it's terrible because the stories are coming back from the border, particularly Poland, is quite harrowing. So I went to the central train station about 4 days after the bombardment started. And it was horrific. You know, you probably had about 15,000 people all milling around, many without tickets, unsure as to when their train was leaving, whether they would get on the train. There was no ticketing system in place. The only rule was women with children at first place, and then women on their own who had second place. So if you're a young man or an older guy, you had to really fight onto those trains. And I filmed and took photos of people, you know, literally just throwing their children onto the train, trying to squeeze into the last few spaces available. So people in Kyiv have seen the bombardment and the awful destruction that has been wreaked on Kharkiv, which is the second city in Ukraine, over on the east part of the country, near the Russian border. That city has suffered more than any other city. People expect that level of destruction to arrive in Kyiv. So that's why they all want to leave as soon as possible.
And what have you found in Odessa? Because you mentioned earlier about how, you know, one of the reasons for the, you know, the fear about saboteurs is the large number of people who would vote 30%, you said, you know, would vote for the kind of pro-Russian parties in normal times. Odessa is a more of a Russian, would have been in normal times more of a Russian stronghold even than that. Isn't that right?
It would have been, yes. But what's very interesting about this conflict, I mean, there's so many interesting things about it, and terrible things about it, but old identities are changing. You know, the idea that you're kind of you're more, you associate yourself more with a Russian or cultural heritage, that changed. It changed a bit after the Maidan Revolution, which was a kind of a victory of liberal democracy over corrupt autocracy, if you like, and people. You know, it was shifted a little bit towards more of a Ukrainian patriotic ideal, but it was very much a liberal democratic slash Europe rather than a Ukrainian one. And so people in Odessa, especially the younger generation, they relate to that. So even though they don't speak Ukrainian, they might think that some Ukrainian elements of Ukrainian culture are a bit too conservative for them, but they still want to be Ukrainian because it's associated with the liberal democratic ideals. And in the last 5 or 6 years, Russia more repressive, more autocratic, more insular, nationalistic, and more conservative. So Odessans have shifted a bit more towards Ukraine, a Ukrainian identity in the last 6 years. But, you know, the biggest change, I believe, in identity was the last week, you know, when Russia started to become residential complexes in like Chernigov and Kherson, and killing young children, and for the whole country to see all those video clips on social media, that very much closed the door for anyone who might be interested in embracing a Russian cultural identity here in Odessa. People who don't even speak Ukrainian are joining the Ukrainian army to fight against Russian speakers. Who are coming here to take over? So you know, it's
that's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Because on one of the many disastrous indication of how many disastrous ways this I think that this has been for Vladimir Putin, he has helped forge a sense of Ukrainian nationhood in this country, which he said wasn't a nation but was actually Russian. And through his actions, through his murderous actions, he's actually creating a Ukraine that he insists doesn't exist.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you know, like pre-pandemic, Putin was a very canny operator. Something happened, something tripped inside his head. Maybe it's just 2 years of isolation. But the decisions he's made in the last few weeks seem to be gross self-destructive. Ukraine, of being a country under conflict between the Russians and the Ukrainian-speaking population, and that's a conflict that Putin, if he was still as canny as he was in the past, would have figured out how to divide and conquer that. But instead, all the actions that he's done have led to, you know, Sweden and Finland closer than ever to join NATO, unifying Ukraine as a country, unifying Ukraine and the EU, creating, you know, almost a new superpower out of the EU. So everything Putin is against strategically is now coming to fruition because of the terrible self-destructive decisions he's made in the last few.
And Johnny, what have you found in Odessa? Because it's a critical city for from the point of view of whatever goals Russia have, and it's a critical place for Ukraine to hold as well. So what is actually happening there as we speak on Friday evening?
Well, the city, well, right now it's curfew, so there's nobody out in the streets, and the assumption is by the authorities and the military that anyone who unauthorized who is out in the street will be deemed to be a saboteur. So they will be stopped and frisked and arrested, and perhaps even worse. So nobody goes out in the street during the curfew hours. So right now it's deathly quiet. During the day, there are people milling around. There are some shops open. More shops here open and more people walking around the streets than in Kyiv city center. But it's a bit like Barcelona in that it's a big enough city with a high density population in a small place, but about 10 miles long of beaches. So it overlooks the Black Sea, and just over the edge of the horizon, there are a flotilla of Russian warships and amphibious landing ships. And apparently there are estuaries about like 20 or 30 miles to the east and about 40 miles to the west, both of which are easy places for these amphibious landers to invade. So people are expecting that to happen in the next couple of days. And presumably that will be accompanied by airstrikes, by, you know, general kind of chaotic situation to kind of give cover to these fairly dangerous amphibious landing vehicles. But I read another piece of military analysis that says that they don't have enough resources, enough human resources on those amphibious landers to enact a real invasion. So it might not happen for another week, while the main invasion task force along the south takes over the next city along, which is Nikolaev. So about 2 hours east of here, there's the city of Kherson, which is already surrounded. And actually, you know, it's been surrounded and has been taken. So I spoke to a guy today whose friends are in Kherson, and apparently fighting has stopped there. The place is quiet. People are starting to walk around, but there are just, you know, Russian tanks and armored vehicles everywhere, Russian checkpoints. So they've taken Kherson.
And do the people expect when that is taken, because it's one of those things that I imagine people are curious about when they say somewhere has been taken. Do people expect it to remain like that? Like, I know you possibly can't anticipate it, but or do they expect that whilst Russia takes somewhere like that, there may again emerge Ukrainian resistance?
I don't know. I mean, obviously I think people expected that it's gone, you know, because Russia has an army that's 10 times the size of Ukraine's army. But, you know, I think war is a game of momentum, you know, and if, for example, you know, Russia gets bogged down for a long time in some of its other areas, then it could be pushed back. It could be crushed. But, you know, strategically, it's the first city that they've fully taken. But not only are they taking the city, they're taking the port, they're taking the airport. They're suddenly have got a lot more supply lines than they did previously. Kherson is directly connected to Crimea, so they can literally just drive troops and equipment along the roads there to shore up
the front in Kherson, which is moving towards the west now. The next town will be Nikolaev, and then Odessa after that. So it's only 2 hours down the road. Military analysts believe that maybe the amphibious invasion of Odessa won't occur until the main southern force will take over the next town along the coast to Odessa.
And what do people expect to happen apart from, you know, the terror of what could happen in where people are living? What do they expect to happen in terms of the talks that are ongoing, any attempts for peace? Like the no-fly zone has again been ruled out by NATO again on Friday. But what do they feel, and what are the chances are of some kind of settlement or some success from the talks that have taken place?
I don't think anyone is really thinking about specific strategies for settlement. Certainly the emotion is still one of defiance. Fight till the end. People will not accept a settlement, a compromise at this point. It'll probably take a lot longer before they're exhausted and before they're demoralized, before they might agree to some settlement. So I don't expect to see that for a long time, actually. Ultimately, what people fear the most is that they get absorbed into Russia, they lose their freedom, they lose their democracy, and that the local administrations get replaced by these kind of mafia runs, like corrupt local regimes where people are just looking, you know, trying to shake everybody down for money and privileges, and there's no real economic development. You know, people fear that the whole of Ukraine will become a frozen conflict zone in the same way that the Donbass did after the 2014 war, in the same way that in northwest Georgia, the Abkhazian Republic became just a frozen zone, recognized by any other country, no trade taking place. So these are the kind of long-term fears of people. But there's another issue at play here, which is a significant kind of determinant of battlefield outcomes here. And that's what's happening in Russia. In the streets of St. Petersburg and Moscow, this is the first weekend now that people have to kind of sit back and contemplate what the hell is happening in this world. And I just know from all the people that I've spoken to in Moscow that they are all very scared and very angry. There's an expectation that martial law will be declared in Russia. I think Facebook and Twitter is down in Russia. People expect perhaps the whole internet might go down. All of the last vestiges of kind of independent media that were operating the city, they were closed down, and all of the journalists fled the country for fear of their lives. Apparently, the cities are just full of interior ministry troops, and they are kind of randomly arresting people. So this is a very, very dark period for Russia as well. And as each day goes on, and the real stranglehold of those very extreme sanctions start to dig down into the Russian economy, all economic activity there, I suspect, will just come to a halt. People won't be going to work on Monday. How's that going to evolve in the next few days? Who knows? But I would guess that, you know, Ukraine is more likely to get a kind of a clear victory out of this whole situation if something happens to Putin in Moscow. That's more likely, I'd say, than a clear military victory.
Johnny, stay safe there. And we're like looking forward to reading more of your dispatches for the Currency. And as we mentioned there, I was talking to Vladimir Ishenko yesterday as well. And we'll just go to that interview now. But thank you, Johnny, and stay safe there. And as I said, yeah, we talked to Vladimir Ishenko, and we asked him to begin with as well about Vladimir Putin's latest statements. This was on Thursday, about his doubling down when in his conversation with Emmanuel Macron.
Yeah.
Vladimir, thank you very much for speaking at this time to us. We're talking on Thursday evening, and we've just been reading reports about a call between Vladimir Putin and Emmanuel Macron, where he repeated that his objective was the neutralization, demilitarization, and denazification of Ukraine. When you read the reports from what Vladimir Putin is saying, where do you see this going over the next while?
I think Putin is deadly furious, and we need to understand that he bet everything on this invasion, and he cannot let himself lose in Ukraine. He cannot let Russia be defeated in Ukraine. Because if they would be defeated, it's very likely that not only his power would be challenged in Russia, either by massive protests or by more likely by an elite coup d'etat against Putin, but also his life would be in danger. The massive reaction from the world in sanctions, the remilitarization of the European Union, the increase of the NATO troops in Europe, they are all understandably against Russia interests. And if he went into this invasion poorly planned and was defeated, that would so he can't allow to do this. And so they I'm afraid that at this moment, it's all the speculations. And we also know that many experts, me included, were mistaken about the strategy of Putin. Many people didn't believe that he would even start this invasion, because there were so many risks that are now in play. But anyway, he made this bet, and I'm afraid that in this situation, in case he's gonna lose and he'll be seen this, he may try to replay the Caribbean crisis and upscale the danger and threats to the West and actually to the whole world, up to that level that when he would be like putting his finger on the red button, he would wait that Biden at that moment would call him and would say, Vladimir, okay, let's talk now. Something like that. And at that moment, he would feel his historical grandeur and replay the Kennedy, Khrushchev,
Cuban missile crisis.
Unfortunately, so he is at that position that he would go up to that line that he would indeed blackmail with the use of the nuclear weapons.
And so when you say that he won't allow it, that is what you're talking about. You feel that there is no... from where we are, and a week into this, it does seem to be something that has gone so badly for Russia so far. But you don't feel that there is any way from where they are now and where Putin is in terms of his own power base in Moscow. that he could allow it to be some kind of, you know, the talks that are taking place, the idea of any kind of negotiated settlement, you don't see that as something that's possible for him?
I actually see it's possible, but it's all the talks, all the negotiations require the willingness of both sides to negotiate. And so far, the EU strategy was primarily to sanctions and to uplift the sanctions and to send weapons to Ukraine. But if if EU would be limited only to this, to the sanctions and to the weapons, that means, and without pushing for settling some compromise solution between Ukraine and Russia, that would mean that EU is actually interested in this war, and not exactly EU, but the US, because that would mean that they prolong the war for many months, maybe even years. They are turning Ukraine into a kind of Afghanistan for Russia, where Russia would be exhausted and defeated. But that is also, we also need to understand that this is a huge sacrifice of Ukrainian lives, of Ukrainian cities, of Ukrainian economy. The country that was one of considerably developed when by the end of the Soviet Union, and it could seriously think that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Ukraine could become something like France or Finland. That was, of course, a huge visual thinking, but nevertheless, the degradation of Ukraine would be inconceivable. It would be one of the maybe of the world record of the economic and social degradation that would happen, especially after this Putin's war. So there should be a push from the EU for a negotiated solution for a peaceful settlement. And there are some frameworks that possibly could be discussed, and maybe they discussed among the elites, but I don't know. But we always see this rush to apply for the EU membership. Ukraine applied, but also today Georgia applied, Moldova applied. If this application, and the Ukrainian application was supported by the European Parliament, if this is serious, if the European elites are ready to actually consider a serious membership plan for Ukraine, that could be part of the solution. Ukraine gets EU membership, and Putin gets, for example, the neutral status and some compromise on Crimea and Donbass.
What would that compromise be? Would that be part of them being part of Russia, or like that's not? Is that something?
No, well, it's very clear that Putin's idea is to force Ukraine to recognize Crimean annexation, and that would be impossible for any Ukrainian government unless forced in this bloody war. For example, recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk republics, for example, in the borders of the administrative provinces within Ukraine, so more than they actually controlled before the war started. And then they could, for instance, apply to join Russia. For example, but I think there could be a space of this discussion. But the important point here that basically this exchange of EU membership for neutral status allows both sides to present it as a victory, and that means that this settlement could be stable. Because for Ukrainians were protesting for European choice since 2013, the Euromaidan revolution. And indeed, quite many people supported, not all of Ukrainians, of course, but quite many actually supported this. And according to the polls, this, Ukrainians would, the overwhelming majority would support EU membership. So yeah, this is a popular thing. And of course, it, this would be the an opportunity for Ukraine's development. And Zelensky could present it as a victory that Ukrainians were fighting for Europe and they won it.
And do you think...
And Putin could present as the victory the compromises on Crimea and Donbass and the neutral status for Ukraine. So for him, it would not be a defeat. He would claim to Russian people, to Russian elite, so no, that
the prospect of NATO,
that
what,
losses, they were not in vain.
Yeah,
they kind of like achieved some of their goals.
And when you say, when you mentioned that, you know, this Afghanistan, and we know how wearing that was on the Soviet Union, then is it possible for Ukraine to even be like Afghanistan, which at that time, you know, it was a different era in terms of communication. It was a place further away. Ukraine, an independent nation, but it is like the lives of Ukrainian people and Russian people have been so intertwined for so long that presumably the damage and that this is doing to Putin among Russian people, who are, some of whom are protesting, you know, a lot more would probably protest if they could. This isn't something that they feel can be explained away the way Afghanistan was initially explained away to people in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, of course, and there are many differences, certainly. And one of them is that Putin is not bringing any kind of progress to Ukraine, unlike the Soviet Union, to Afghanistan. We also know that Najibullah government is still recalled with some nostalgia among Afghani people. But in case of Russian invasion to Ukraine, Russia cannot offer any kind of progressive model for Ukraine. Russia is basically the same kleptocratic capitalism as it is in Ukraine.
But they've also reached the point, the kind of the worst point of Afghanistan within a week, haven't they? Like, it's kind of, you know, it's taken what took years. It's taken a week to kind of have that sort of poor morale. Everyone turned against them. It's extraordinary how quickly they've lost the propaganda war.
I think they even didn't plan well the propaganda war, and they lost it basically in the very first day. So the whole world is, most of the world, I mean, the governments have different opinions, and we've seen that China is almost openly supporting, and India and quite many third world countries in the global south, they have an ambiguous relation to what's happening, but the public opinion, at least to those who watch major international media, they see Russia as an unambiguous aggressor in Ukraine. It's not Afghanistan yet, and you need to understand that Russian forces are still advancing, and they create a threat to Nikolaev, to Odessa. They create a threat to a large group of Ukrainian forces concentrated in eastern Ukraine, near Donbass front line. They may be encircled. They are not rushing with taking Kyiv, but it's also a threat if they encircle the city and may try kind of like a blockade. The humanitarian catastrophe is definitely coming forward. And if the level of resistance among Ukrainians is also quite high, and they are ready to fight the Russian forces, and if supplied with Western weapons, they would continue the resistance. And we also need to understand that that it would mean the loss of thousands, maybe eventually millions of lives, and complete destructions of some of the biggest Ukrainian cities. And as I said, it looks like Putin backed everything, and he would not step back, for example, from turning Kyiv into Chechen capital Grozny, which was brutally assaulted and destroyed. So that's a real threat that should be prevented. So not only sanction Russia, not only send weapons to Ukrainians, but also try to push for the peaceful settlement. And there are some frameworks for the compromise. At least it should be all the forces put into the fighting this framework, and not expecting that Putin would just step back and recognize the defeat, and would just let it go. It's extremely risky for him to be defeated in Ukraine. He won't allow himself to be defeated.
How much do you think, when you talk about the sense of paranoia he has, how much do you feel that Putin's own idea of Russian nationalism, as somebody whose work is centers on nationalism in Ukraine and beyond, how much do you feel that Putin's own view of Russian nationalism has played a part in the misjudgments he's made in terms of Ukraine? Because again, we talk about the denazification. He told the Russian people that the Russian army was going to be welcomed as liberators, this kind of idea, and we know all the other stuff that he came out with in his kind of rambling speech before the invasion. How much of a factor has that been?
I know that some people make this argument that he was completely delusional about Ukraine. I'm not that convinced. Of course, we would see how the events are developing, and maybe it would be just seen as a like massive mistake, the gravest mistake of his life, that was pushed by completely delusional nationalist ideas. The problem is that we actually do not know why this person, Putin, became a bigot nationalist, if he became one. Because that would be very, actually very untypical for the post-Soviet leaders, who are mostly have never been actually any kind of nationalist ideologues, the people driven by ideas. They were almost always cynical pragmatists, and thinking about primarily their money, their power, and how to ensure the lifelong rule in their country and not be killed by a successor. So this is not an ideological politics. This is a very pragmatic, cynical, kleptocratic politics, which dominated the post-Soviet space. Putin was not a leader of any kind of like ideological movement. He is not an ideological person, at least he has not been before. So this idea that this whole war is just a projection of his delusions about Ukraine, at this moment, I could be wrong, but at this moment, it sounds not entirely convincing for me. At least it doesn't have an explanation how Putin just turned into a nationalist fanatic. Of course, there could be misjudgments. And I've read a very interesting analysis that discussed some of the analytics that was produced by the Russian Security Service, FSB, that studied the moods in Ukraine, and they found, expectedly, that Ukrainians do not trust the government, that the support for Zelensky is dropping, that Ukrainians actually not so much interested in the and national ideas, but mostly about the wages, prices, jobs. They are very materialistically pragmatical people, and so on and so forth. So that could lead to a conclusion that the Russian invasion would be easy, that Ukrainians would not resist as much as they do now, and that Russians could proceed, maybe not welcomed with flowers. I don't even think they expected this. Maybe, and I don't think that they expected that Ukrainians would really greet them as liberators. It's just this whole talk about denazification. I think they don't even believe in that themselves.
Right. Yeah.
But it could lead to a misjudgment that Russian advance would be easy, but they could make a mistake that during the war and the shock of the war, the moods could change rapidly. And those people who were not exactly so much nationally consciousness and Ukrainian patriots, but seeing that their cities are bombed, and seeing the destructions, the loss of their compatriots, they are now simply turning to self-defense. They want to defend themselves, and that could be a mistake in Russian plans.
Because you know, people can have maybe concerned about material stuff or whatever, the cost of living, but they can also have a patriotism that comes alongside that, and a need something, or something like this comes along and sparks that, really, which appears to have happened. But could you talk a bit about President Zelensky then, Volodymyr, because it is extraordinary that the way he has led the country, and you know, it is reading people before the invasion, and before, you know, including yourself, but lots of people, like, this is something that I'm not sure many people would have anticipated for him as a president, that he would have become this figurehead and this rallying point for a nation the way he has done.
Yeah, you're totally right. Most of the people, and these questions were asked in the polls before the invasion started. Something like 60% of Ukrainians said that Zelensky would not manage to be a chief commander in case the war starts. But now he actually shows that he's resilient, and he's ready to lead the nation in defense against Russia. And that's indeed quite a puzzle, because Zelensky, when he became a president, he had zero political experience. He got, and that shows a lot how Ukrainians were disappointed and dissatisfied with the normal politics that they've seen for all the 30 years of Ukrainian independence. The cynical, just kleptocratic politics that they were fed up of. And they voted for a person with a new face that would be simply different from those elites.
Hmm.
The vote primarily against Poroshenko, one of the richest oligarchs and a dinosaur of Ukrainian politics. He started his political career in 1990s. But Zelensky, in contrast to him, was seen as a hope, as a new face. And in the first year, he had an overwhelming support, over 70%. And he actually had a chance to use this support to make some unpopular decisions, for example, to push for the implementation of the Minsk Accords. For different reasons, he didn't make the choice and he lost that opportunity. And gradually, he was losing his support. The people were saying that those new faces he brought to the parliament, to the government, are often incompetent or often make actually the same corrupt things as the old politicians, and they're not different, and the life is not getting better, and so not so much is changing under the new phase. And the support for Zelensky dropped very significantly, and before the invasion, according to the polls, he could even lose to Poroshenko, according to some polls. And his party was not the number one anymore and would definitely lose to Poroshenko's party. And he alienated the so-called pro-Russian position, blocking the TV stations and putting the Viktor Medvedchuk, a personal friend of Vladimir Putin, under house arrest, the criminal case. And he alienated the richest oligarch in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov, who started to gather kind of a coalition against Zelensky. Zelensky also fired, dismissed the speaker of the parliament, who helped Zelensky to win the elections, and was seen as a very promising a candidate against Zelensky. But now, in the times of war, he performed unexpectedly well. And I've read some opinions that Zelensky denied the threat of the invasion, as is well known. He said to Western journalists, "So I'm the president of Ukraine, and I know better what's going on here, and don't tell me about this imminent invasion." So he was wrong, and Ukrainian intelligence was wrong, and most of Ukrainians were actually wrong, and they did not believe in the invasion. And many of the experts on post-Soviet politics also didn't believe in the invasion because they understood the huge risks for Russia. But some people thought that Zelensky is denying this simply because he has like plan B, and in case of invasion, he would just take the first flight and would just escape Ukraine and leave the country to be taken by Putin. But he didn't do this, and he shows extraordinary qualities. If you think about how little experience he has, but he's staying in Kyiv and he leads the defense, and he should be appreciated for this.
Have you been surprised by the unity as well of the reaction, you know, the economic sanctions, the depth, the unity, the severity of them? From the EU, from the West, is that something that has surprised you?
Yeah, it's actually surprised me because during this discussion of the imminent invasion and Russian demands to NATO, we've seen quite evident discord among NATO. So Germany had its own opinion, France had its own opinion, and they were not aligning with the US. Now, Putin actually united the West against him, and EU is looks like even harsher on Russia now, breaking all the previous collaboration, the project, the Nord Stream 2, and pushing for very strong sanctions against Russia. Honestly, I don't have a good explanation for this, but one of the reasons could be that actually most of European elites didn't believe in the invasion, and they now are feeling kind of especially infuriated.
And it's another defeat for Putin, isn't it, to have actually united the EU, which the destabilization of which has been something he's been striving for a long time. So actually to have united them is something that he will enrage him as well. But Vladimir, before we let you go, I just want to ask you maybe like what a slightly personal question in terms of how you like what you're hearing from your family in Ukraine now, what messages you're getting and how much communication you're able to have with people who are there.
Well, of course, I follow many colleagues, friends, opinion leaders from Ukraine. So, yeah, I can see what people are thinking there, what they're doing there. And my parents are in Kyiv, unfortunately, and they do not want to leave. And I cannot find some convincing words for that. But
why don't they want to leave?
Yeah, that's a good question. And if I would understood it completely, but one of the reasons they don't want to turn into refugees, for example, they want to stay in the city where they lived most of their lives, and so they don't want to leave the flat, and maybe they're afraid of marauders, the robbers, I don't know. But of course, it's understandable, it's becoming very dangerous now. And God forbid they would start a bloody assault on Kyiv. And in Kyiv, the resistance would be very strong because many people from all around Ukraine, from the Western Ukraine as well, they are coming to Kyiv and enlisting to the kind of like militia. And they are ready to fight Russians. And if they would start to shoot from the living blocks, from the houses, of course, the Russians would shoot them back. And that would turn Kyiv into Stalingrad or Grozny. And of course, that would be the disaster for the families who would still be there, probably without electricity, without water, without heating. Mm-hmm. March in Ukraine could be quite cold. So that would be a definite disaster, and we need to make everything to prevent it.
Mm-hmm. Vladimir, thank you, and I wish you and your family well. Thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.